Morning, everyone. Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday morning, the last day of the APHA annual meeting. Delighted to see you here with us today. My name is Dr. Bill Keck. I'm vice chair of the board of directors of Medical Education Cooperation with Cuba, which we affectionately prefer to call MEDIC. And I'm pleased to be able to moderate a panel of distinguished speakers this morning. Because there will be slides, our speakers have elected to sit in the audience until they're speaking so that they can see the slides clearly as well. Certainly, this audience knows that diabetes is a major problem in the world, and including the United States, where over 29 million Americans have been diagnosed with the disease. That's really 8% of the total population and more than a quarter of people over the age 65. Most of them, and one quarter of the total are undiagnosed, so they are unaware that they have the disease. And the rates, of course, are disproportionate. We know that Native Americans have the highest diabetes prevalence in the world. 16% of Native Americans and Alaska Natives suffer from the disease. This compared to nearly 13% of African Americans, about 12% of Hispanics, and some 8% of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, and really just 7% of non-Hispanic whites. Excuse me. Diabetes is the seventh leading cause of death in the United States, with considerable underreporting of the disease as an underlying cause, according to the Centers for Disease Control. And the disease is indeed epidemic in the USA, growing at alarming rates in most states, and affecting nearly 30 times the people it did about 50 years ago. The most common type is type 2 diabetes, with aging, poor diet, physical inactivity, high blood pressure, and obesity playing an even bigger role than inherited factors. Between 70,000 and 80,000 diabetics in this country become amputees every year from one of the disease's most onerous complications, diabetic foot ulcers. Add to the human health dimension, you can add the cost to both patients and to federal programs, estimated at some $250 billion annually, with diabetic foot ulcer patients paying double what other diabetics pay for their care. And of course, that doesn't count the cost of years of the disability itself associated with lost income and deeper poverty. The American Diabetes Association estimates that one of every five U.S. healthcare dollars is spent treating diabetes. Meanwhile, in Cuba, an integrated national strategy is one reason for low diabetes mortality, the lowest in the Americas, actually, with decreases reported in 2011 and 2012. Another reason for this success is Cuba's latest R&D breakthrough, a medication called Ibuprofen P, which has already treated 165,000 diabetic foot patients in 26 countries and counting. It's reducing the relative risk for amputation by about 75%. The treatment is in trials in five countries and in Europe, where it's known as EpiPro. But because of the restrictions imposed on Cuba by the five decades old U.S. embargo, the treatment is not available for Americans. MEDIC took a bipartisan delegation to Havana to see diabetes care and Ibuprofen P at work. And as it happened, that delegation was there on the eve of the December 17th announcement by Presidents Obama and Castro about a growing rapprochement between the two countries. The group included Representative Diana DeJette, who is co-chair of the Diabetes Caucus of Congress, which, by the way, is the largest caucus in Congress, has 345 members. There were other caucus members that went, diabetes experts and patient advocates, and our speakers were part of that experience, three from the U.S. and one from Cuba. This panel is going to present the relevance of what was learned for public health in the United States of that trip. And they'll also explore the implications of improved U.S.-Cuban relations for greater access to Cuban innovations in diabetes prevention, treatment, and care. I'll introduce each speaker before they address you. and can tell you now that none have financial disclosures to make. And we'll ask you to please hold your questions until the end, so write them down as we go. And our first speaker, as you can see, is Dr. Dabney Evans. Dr. Evans is Assistant Professor of Global Health at the Hubert Department of Health and the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University in Atlanta. She is a mixed methods researcher of issues affecting vulnerable populations at the intersection of public health and human rights. She's Director of the Center for Humanitarian Emergencies in the Rollins School and the Emory University Institute of Human Rights. She's also a member of the Board of Directors of MEDIC, and the title of her presentation, as you can see, The Cuban Experience in Prevention, Care, and Treatment of Diabetes and Its Relevance for U.S. Public Health. So, Dr. Evans, if you would.
Buenos dias. Okay, that was better than good morning. Everybody's awake now. I've got both sides of the brain firing with the Spanish going. Well, thank you, Bill, so much for that wonderful introduction, and thank you all for being here on this last day of APHA for this early morning session. My task today is to share with you, is to set the stage. And I've had the opportunity, as Bill alluded to travel to Cuba over the past 13 years, so I've seen a lot of changes during that time, and I've made a lot of observances about the system. So I really want to give a little bit of an orientation to the Cuban public health system before we delve into diabetes. So as Bill said, I have no financial conflicts to disclose. I wish that I did, but I don't. So first, before we begin talking about diabetes and really this revolutionary treatment that the Cubans have developed, I think it's important for us to understand the public health system. Because for those that may not be aware, the public health system, and it is a system, is different from what we have in the United States. So as an overview, I start with the 1960s, and I talk about the development of the polyclinic system. The polyclinic system includes what we would consider to be three levels of care. So there's the hospital level, the tertiary level, the secondary level, which is ambulatory outpatient care, and these are referred to polyclinics. And then we also have primary care at the patient-doctor level. In the 1970s, and one of the things that I should emphasize here is that the Cuban system is constantly evolving and changing. This is not a static system. It's very responsive to the needs of the population. So this is really what I want to demonstrate here. In the 70s, the focus of medicine becomes prevention and public health. So unlike here in the U.S., where public health and medicine operate very separately from one another, medicine is actually a part of the public health system. And at that time, in the late 60s, early 70s, Cuban physicians begin to serve abroad. In the 80s, the development of this family doctor nurse program begins, and I'll go into the details of each of these elements a little bit later on. And then, of course, we know in the 1990s that there were major geopolitical changes that impacted the economy of Cuba, and this period in Cuba is referred to as the special period. In the 2000s, and I remember this from my early days of traveling to Cuba, one of the most common phrases that I heard was, "We live like poor people, but we die like rich people." And in one hand, this was a wonderful accomplishment, because it meant that Cuba, as a developing country, was not facing the infectious diseases that other developing countries were facing. However, what it foreshadowed was the challenge that the developed states continue to face today, which is the challenge of chronic diseases, including diabetes. So the Cubans were ahead of their time on that side. So you all may know that there were some goals set by WHO for health for all by the year 2000. It's now nearly 2016, and most countries haven't met those standards, but Cuba did. And in 2015, Cuba became the first and so far the only country to eliminate the mother-to-child transmission of HIV and syphilis. So these are major health accomplishments that outside of the realm of public health and sometimes even within public health may not be known. So I just share this to emphasize that this is a system that is actually working and making major inroads into public health challenges. So I mentioned already briefly the three-tiered system, and I want to point out some elements of this three-tiered system. The first thing is that coverage is universal. Everyone is in the system, and everyone has access to the system. I also mentioned this element of the interconnection between public health and medicine, and that's really, really crucial because we know that public health focuses on prevention, and in our context, medicine focuses on treatment, and there's often a disconnect between the two. So having an integrated system that sees all of these levels, the need for prevention and the need for treatment when necessary, is really important. And I also mentioned already these three tiers. So at the primary level, we have a lot of community groups, and then the family doctors and nurses who are the health professionals that work on the ground. And I often say that the Cuban system is an epidemiologist's dream. It's an island, there's a relatively small population, and the family doctor nurse teams work in specific geographically defined areas. So I was always amazed when I walk into any family doctor nurse office and that doctor can spout off the statistics for the patients that they serve. They can tell you exactly how many diabetics they have, exactly how many pregnant women they have, exactly how many children. So it's really an amazing fact that family doctors and nurses are actually collecting the epidemiologic data. If you walk into an American doctor's office and ask them how many patients they have, they would probably have a hard time telling you that, not to mention how many patients of a certain disease profile. The secondary level, as I mentioned, are the polyclinics, and these are ambulatory outpatient care centers that provide a host of services and work in collaboration with the family doctor nurse teams. And then finally, the tertiary level of hospitals that we're all familiar with. So this is just a brief graphic to explain the levels of these systems, which I've pretty much talked through. But this graph here describes the ways in which the health institutions, such as the Ministry of Health, relate to the government structures of Cuba. And these slides are uploaded in the APHA system, so I won't dwell on this one in particular. So a little bit more about the facts and figures of the system that I'm describing. One doctor-nurse team, or consultorio, which is actually the office of the doctor, serves up to about 600 people, which usually equates to about 150 families. One polyclinic serves about 30 to 40 consultorios, and there are about 58 doctors and 74 nurses per 10,000 people. And Cuba, some of you may know, has the best doctor-to-patient ratio in the world. A very different model than what we have here. And interestingly, 63% of physicians are women, also different than most of the rest of the world. So I wanted to take just a moment to look at Cuba as it compares to its neighbors. So I have some basic health statistics with Cuba's data compared to one of its island neighbors, the Dominican Republic, and also the large Goliath to the north, the U.S. And I think it's important to consider the development differences between these countries. So economically, the Dominican Republic is much closer to Cuba, but the U.S. has health data that are different in other ways. So what you notice is that Cuba and the Dominican Republic have roughly the same population size. And notice infant mortality, our gold standard for public health. You see that Cuba has a rate which is lower than the U.S. And I remember when Cuba hit 6 in its infant mortality rate, and everybody was saying, it can't get any lower than this. And now the infant mortality rate is 4. So these are really amazing accomplishments. When you look at the U.S. and you disaggregate these data by race, it's really disturbing because the rates for African Americans are double that of white Americans. So we're talking about 12, which is much closer to a developing country rate. You can also see these other data here. I use infant mortality as the gold standard, but you can see how the countries compare on these very standard public health indicators. And the sources for these are at the end in my references. So we see that infant mortality is the gold standard for health measurement and how Cuba is faring in that respect. And I mentioned already this phenomenon of living like poor people but dying like rich people. When we look at causes of mortality for the U.S. and Cuba, they're roughly the same. Heart disease, stroke, and cancer are major causes of disease. And diabetes, as Bill already mentioned, is a major cause of both morbidity and mortality in both countries, 9th in Cuba and 7th in the U.S. So this is a concern that we share with our neighbor to the south, and something that we should perhaps consider collaborating on. So I also share here percent GDP dedicated to public health. So I think it's really important to recognize that Cuba spends 8.8% of its GNP, that's public expenditure. The U.S. spends far more, double, 17.1%. This is public expenditure only. And yet, our health indicators are worse. So we really have to consider how we're allocating our resources. So the big questions for me coming from these data are, in the U.S., we ask, how can a particular disease get a bigger piece of the pie? Or how can health get a bigger piece of the overall budget? But in Cuba, the question is, how do we make the pie better? How do we use that 8% to get the best outcomes that we possibly can? Well, the answer to that question has to do with some underlying guiding principles. And the guiding principles that are really embedded both in law and in practice in the Cuban public health system, the ones that I've noted are as follows. First of all, health is a government responsibility and a citizen's right. It's included in the Cuban Constitution. And this is not uncommon. Actually, two-thirds of countries in the world include the right to health in their constitution. So the U.S. is fairly exceptional in this regard. Health care is universal and free. And there's an emphasis on preventive care. And this is music to the ears to all of us that work in public health, right? Because we know that that prevention goes a long way. Cuba also uses participatory approaches to population health. So you saw the triangle that I have up earlier, and those really incorporate some of those participatory approaches. There's a focus on scientific advancement, and you'll hear more specifically about the treatment for diabetes here shortly. And there's also a commitment to medical cooperation with other nations. So I just wanted to share here, I've already talked a little bit about the primary health care and the family doctor nurse program and community organizations. These are some photos from some of my earlier visits, and you see here, this is a family doctor nurse clinic with a physician and a nurse there. And then in this case, the physician is male, so we have to remember that's the exception. And then here, a photo of a polyclinic, again, the ambulatory outpatient center. So I want to shift now to begin to talk about diabetes, and I want to share with you the ways in which this system is addressing diabetes. So I mentioned already the polyclinics, and I also want to mention that there are specialized diabetes centers, and we're going to be talking a lot about this diabetic foot ulcer treatment today. So there are a couple of things that these diabetes centers do, and one of the things that they do is focus on the treatment of these diabetic foot ulcers, and there's going to be much more detail about this later on. But I want to mention that that's one of the functions of these centers. But the other, and that's a treatment function. So that's important for us to realize. But I also want you to recognize, and this is the way that we think about the integration of care, that these diabetes centers also do prevention. So they have use educational strategies and health education. So for people that are newly diagnosed with diabetes, whether they're type 1 or type 2 diabetics, they participate at the outset of their diagnosis in week-long courses, which is basically teaching them how to manage their treatment. And this is something that also happens in the U.S. However, most of the time when people are diagnosed, and particularly with type 1 diabetics, they may enter the hospital and they may receive some diabetes education in the hospital over the course of a couple of days, and then they're kind of left to their own devices. This is a much more intensive process, and it also includes family training. And I should mention as well that there's a specific training that is particular to adolescents. So there's been some research that has shown that diabetic adolescents are more likely to engage in other risky behaviors including smoking and engaging in unsafe sex practices, because they're in a time of adolescence. And when they have a health diagnosis that impacts them so significantly, they can begin to act out in other ways. And so this week-long intensive training for adolescents is particularly important, and also for family members and even friends as a support system. So just a few examples of prevention practices there. So this is a photo of a billboard on the street that says, "The world needs the globalization of solidarity." So I'll just close here by saying that I think there are a lot of lessons that we can learn from Cuba, both in terms of their health system, but in particular with regards to the care and treatment of diabetes. And I've mentioned just these few examples, and I think you're going to hear from my other colleagues some very exciting developments that are scientific developments. So I thank you again for being here and for listening.